This is the third interview with Miriam Ellen DeFord, and took place on 8/23/73 in her hotel suite at the Ambassador Hotel. Since the last interview, she had been hospitalized for a broken shoulder and pelvis. She looked considerably more frail than in March, and it was quite obvious that her hearing had deteriorated further. There are several points in the interview where she clearly does not hear the question being asked, and sometimes will attempt to guess what it was I was asking and might be on a different subject, or in some cases will actually continue the train of thought that was being developed. Most of these points are rather obvious. The interview covered a series of topics. We began with a discussion of women in the unions and the lip service paid by unions to women's suffrage. From there, went into a discussion of the Federated Press and the Newspaper Guild. Of particular interest is a very lengthy discussion on birth control, which included information about her own birth control knowledge and practices, the availability of abortions, etc. Of interest also is a very lengthy discussion on the split in the feminist movement between radicals and conservatives, and some discussion of what happened to women after 1920. Beside the discussion of feminism, there is a very lengthy description of the Anti-Evolution League and of her experiences on the Federated Press, and discussion of her writing.
Details on the suffrage period and about your feminist ideas, but I also wanted to talk about the changes in the role of women in the trade union, since you were so actively...
Well, of course, the thing is that my union activities were later than that period. I mean, I went with the Federated... I had done some liberal journalism with that, but my real work as a liberal journalist started in 1956, which is pretty late for you. No, it ended in 1956, started in 1921. I was 35 years with them, and they died. And then I was with Labor's Daily for a year, and they died. I don't know what I killed them or what. So that...
But did you, in the period of the 20s, when you started
I was with the Federated Press, covering all the hearings and trials and conventions and going around and getting fiddles. I had a nice job as a tent duster because I was... The Red Squad found me getting news in the IWW headquarters around the corner from the office.
Did you, in those days in the 20s, did you have any feeling about the way that women within the trade union movement were recognized?
Well, not so far as I personally was concerned, but of course it was very obvious that most of the unions at that time didn't even admit women. And the few women who were in unions, they were nearly all left-wing unions and left-wing women. And they were all at a great disadvantage. They were all, as they still do, getting much less for the same job. And I don't know that I can't tie up any particular connection between the union movement and the suffrage movement, except that a good many of them at that time did, at their annual conventions, pass a perfunctory resolution that they were in favor of votes for women. But that was about all they ever did about it, and if they thought they were going to get it, they probably wouldn't have passed it. Of course, still, building construction unions and some others don't admit women.
How about the printers' union in San Francisco had women, didn't they?
Which one?
The printers.
I don't know an awful lot about the printers as typographical union, but I do know that they had women linotype operators way back in the very beginning. I knew a woman in Colorado Springs that been when I guess I must have known her 40 years ago, and she had been Planet type operator ever since there was one. So I've even forgotten her name. It was Nell something, but anyway, she died a long time ago. But as far as I know, the Primitive Union always has another woman on exactly the same terms as men. Of course, the Newspaper Guild always did.
You don't recall in your early labor reporting days actual fights that the women had within the union for organizing the women? For instance...
No, in my very earliest newspaper days, of course, it was practically unknown to have a woman on a paper who wasn't in the women's department. Except we did, I remember, on the old Philadelphia North American, which I went to in 1906. They had one woman photographer. Well, I think she was employed mostly to go out and snap society ladies who were going to get married or something like that. Whether she got the same pay as the men photographers, I wouldn't know. She never told me. I do know that in my first job, of course, you can't compare salaries because of the difference. And as my husband used to say, whatever happens, you get your hay and oats. So that we all got infinitesimally small salaries. But I know that I was in the Sunday women's department. We got out an 8-page section every Sunday, and my editor was getting $23 a week, and I was getting 10. When they came after me and got me back, they raised me to 15. But that was the time we spoke with all the Sunday editor who made all of $50 a week. So you can't, and they used to give me 50 cents for dinner money when I worked overtime. I get a very good dinner, a very good restaurant for that. So you can't, all you can say is the difference. You can't do anything with the actual sums.
Now, within the Federated Press itself, were there other...
Well, that, of course. The Federated Press, like your outfit, was always very, very hard up for money. And we got only a token payment I never could have lived on.
Oh.
I think I got $20 a month for 35 years. When I celebrated my 25th anniversary, they sent me a $100 bonus. And when they died, they sent me a $100 bonus. But most of the Federated Press staff worked as volunteers.
Were there many other women working for the Federated Press?
Not very many. There's some. For instance, my boyfriend was still alive, just a year younger than I, Dallas, Carl Brannan. He and his wife worked together, but they had money from other sources, and they never got paid at all. They were the first people to go, first civilians to visit Soviet Russia after the revolution. It's hard for me to remember way back then, but I know there were some women on the staff, but how many, I don't know. As far as I can remember, the Carr Hustler in Detroit was the real head. But the acting chief editor in Washington was always a man. There was never a woman in that position that I know of. I'm sure that I know there were other women, but I didn't know them and I don't remember their names.
When did you actually join the Newspaper Guild?
When did I join? I joined in 1936. I got my 25-year pin in 1951. I guess it'd be 61. And then my second paper having died on me, I took out my honorary withdrawal card. So I still get the big guildsman, so I notice everybody I knew is long ago retired or died.
Within the Newspaper Guild, what were the purport? How many women were there compared to the number of men?
Well, the Newspaper Guild, of course, never made any distinction of sex. But they had nothing to say about whom the papers hired or fired. So
what was the role of most... Because reporting was a very early occupation.
Well, I'll tell you whom you ought to talk to about that, and that's the oldest active woman newspaper reporter in San Francisco is Carolyn Ansbacher on the Chronicle. She still is works for them full time. I mean, a number of women I knew on the Chronicle, but with the exception of Carolyn, they've all either retired or died.
Sylvia
Estacourt, for instance.
How do you spell her last name?
A-M-S-P-A-C-H-E-R. And she spells Carolyn with a Y. C-A-R-O-L-Y-N.
And she's still at the Chronicle?
I haven't seen her. Yeah, she's still at the Chronicle. I haven't seen her for years. I used to know her fairly well.
How old would she be then?
Well, she probably wouldn't thank me. I don't know. But all I know is that she must be well into her 70s. Because she's been on the Chronicle ever since I can remember.
Well, within the Newspaper Guild, were the other women active in the Guild? Did they seem to play similar roles on their...
Well, we've never had of course, I'm either nationally or locally, we've never had a woman president. Usually, locally, in what we call SFUNG, the San Francisco Oakland Newspaper Guild, usually the secretary is a woman, so she can take notes. And sometimes the treasurer has been. But of course, you see, the Newspaper Guild is the CIO union, and it took in not only the editorial, but also advertising, circulation, and business office.
Oh.
So usually the secretary and treasurer come out of the business office.
Did it seem of the women who were in the Guild who were actively working on the papers as...
Oh, yes, there's always been, and of course in recent years, the papers have hired many more women. Of course, we have only two papers left here now, the Chronicle and the Examiner, but they both have women working as regular reporters. I mean...
Did you see changes within your own career as to what happened to women?
Well, I couldn't see so much because after I worked 4 years on the Philadelphia North American, and then I worked for a while on the Boston Post. But after that, I never worked on a daily paper, so I couldn't tell.
When you were working on those papers, were the women...
Oh, at that time, there were no women except in the women's department. And on the Post, I was just a feature writer. I mean, I sent in stories if they wanted, like spending the night in a municipal lodging house for women, that kind of thing.
Now, in terms of the unions, are you aware of something that was called the Workers' Health Bureau in New York?
I know only very vaguely.
Oh,
no, I can't be of any help in that.
In
I don't.
Santa Clara, and I was curious as to how widely known they were. There are a couple of specific areas I'd like to ask you about. One is, I have been coming up with very interesting and diverse information from women about birth control in those early days, what they knew about it, and what they themselves used, and the kinds of experiences they had.
You mean in any union, or I mean any kind of work, or just...
No, this is in birth control.
Oh.
What I'm finding is a tremendous variation, for one thing, in how much women knew. And I've started trying to get information from everybody then about how much they well, of course, with your medical family background, you knew something, but how much the women knew about birth control and what they themselves used and how they got the information in those early days when it was very illegal.
You mean... Are you speaking of reporters or any kind of...
All women.
I don't think I can give you any coherent answer to that because that particular subject never came up and I never had to cover it.
Well, in your own case personally, how did you obtain information about birth control?
About what?
Birth control.
That word?
Birth control.
Oh, birth control. Oh. Well, of course, Margaret Sanger was the one who started all that, and single-handed and serving time in jail and going to England to escape jail and all that. And I used to write for the Birth Control Review, but that was the only close connection I had with it. But I think I was in rather an unusual position to find out about things like that because, as you know, my mother was a doctor. And she didn't know much about birth control herself, I might add. But she was favorably inclined, so that I can't remember when the when Philadelphia got its first birth control society. But whenever it was, I know I was down there helping. All I do now is just belong to the thing and pay my dues, as I can be very active.
Did you personally use some sort of birth control?
You mean not in the way of serving on the staff or
no,
being...
No, did you personally use some method of birth control?
Oh, me? Of course. When I was living in Boston, about to go to San Diego to be married, I knew a woman doctor, a Russian woman, I can't remember her name anymore, a refugee from Tsarist Russia, who instructed me on the use of the, I can't think of the name, you know.
The pessary? The pessary?
Yeah, the pessary. The Dutch pessary, we used to call it.
What was it called?
The Dutch pessary. It seemed to have originated in Holland. It was very embarrassing. You go in a drugstore and you're trying to get the clerk in the corner. It was always a man and whisper to him, did he have any Dutch pessaries? But she showed me how to use it, and I was rather a demi-virgin at the time, so she couldn't demonstrate exactly, but she gave me information, gave me some kind of tablet or something to use before I could use that.
What was that supposed to do?
Well, it was a less reliable form of birth control. One of the, you know, these things about so long that you insert, like a Tampax.
Like a suppository?
Yeah, a suppository. I don't know what was in it, but it was supposed to be a germicide or a spermicide.
And you used both of them?
Well, no, I just used that until I could use the pessary.
I see.
I never used anything but a pessary. It was long before the days of the pill, or the what they call it, the internal device.
Intrauterine device.
That was all that most people just, and they told us what they said. They say now that douching is absolutely useless, but of course in those days you always douched afterwards.
Even though you used the pessary?
Oh yes, even with the pessary, it was safer. Now I remember one horrible thing I did. At that time in the douche, you got a I don't know why I'm having so much trouble remembering the names of these darn things, but it's a very powerful poison, and you've got little tablets like that, and you put it in 3 quarts of water. And one day when I was taking a bath, I discovered that my pessary had become torn, and I was panicky. And I took 3 of these damn things and suck them up, and in consequence I scarred myself very badly and put it in a way had to have a hysterectomy or something. So I don't know whether it was because of that. I've never to my knowledge been pregnant.
Now with the pessary, did you have to have a special instrument for inserting it?
No, we didn't need any instruments. It was very soft rubber, and the middle part was very thin rubber. And you all needed was a little dexterity to learn how to put it in and how to adjust it so it was in the right place. But you, as I remember, you put Vaseline on the heavy edge first to make it easier to insert.
Did it look like the modern diaphragm, or did it?
Well,
look
I don't know because I haven't seen any modern ones, but I can show you just what it looked like. It looked like a little cap. It had this thick, inflated rubber edge and then the thin rubber cap above it.
I think that's the same as the modern diaphragm.
Well, I don't know because it's been a long time since I needed one. But I don't even remember how much they were or how long they lasted, but sooner or later you had to get a new one.
Now, did you have to have a doctor's prescription for it, or could you
No, not at that time. I never had a doctor's prescription for it. Twice when I missed a period and I was afraid that I was pregnant, I went to the doctor, and the first doctor gave me ergot pills and said if they didn't work, he was perfectly willing to perform an abortion. That was in San Diego, it was utterly illegal at the time. The second time, I didn't need it. I knew myself that I could take ergot and it worked.
How common was the giving of the ergotrate when a woman missed her period?
I have no idea because I had a longer, reticent generation that never talked about sex, so I had no idea what anybody else I knew did or used. Except that once I happened to open the bureau door of my mother's and found her douchebag, which was all she used, and it didn't work because she had three of us and two miscarriages.
So you really don't know what the other...
I have no idea what anybody used except me, except back in those days, the same way if you know a really leftist person now, you take it for granted he is or has been a communist. In those days, he was or had been an anarchist. And the Russian woman doctor who gave me all this was an anarchist.
Oh.
And when I lived in Los Angeles about 1916-17, practically all the people I knew were anarchists, including another woman doctor who was the one that I had to go to when I scarred myself so badly and who probably saved my life.
Well, it sounds like there were many more women gynecologists than there are now.
Yes, I think so. Well, of course, in those days, every woman doctor was supposed to be an oncologist or an obstetrician. They were, and of course, still most of them are.
Yeah.
My mother wasn't, but I should say that 90% of her practice was. And I think it was only just recently that I had a woman surgeon who performed my stomach cancer operation, and she's a cancer specialist. And at Kaiser, there are a lot of women who are just a general or specialist, but not gynecologists. In fact, most of the gynecologists there are men.
Did you always go to women gynecologists?
No, not particularly. I never went to anybody for anything except the two times that I had anything to go for.
Well, with the pessary, it didn't have to be specially fitted in terms of the size.
Well, it should have been, of course, and as soon as birth control became a little more respectable and there were regular associations, I think they did fit them and all that. But in my day, I think they were all the same size. Or there may have been two or three sizes, mm-hmm. I don't remember. But you just learned to do it yourself. I suppose it didn't always work. But I'm sure that it was unusual to use that. They had to be imported. They weren't made in this country. And they were very expensive. And I'm sure that most women either use a douche or also their husbands use a condom.
Did you have difficulty finding this doctor or because you were involved in anarchist circles you knew about him?
Not particularly. No. I never had... See, I, until recent years, I was a very healthy specimen. I never had... Thing to do with doctors except for recurrent tonsillitis. I knew how to handle it.
So it wasn't that difficult to actually find a doctor who would give you birth control then?
I think it was extremely difficult. I just happened to be lucky with, I think, slightly phony doctor that I recommended to in San Diego. I was being there only 6 weeks. So I don't even remember his name. Afterwards, he treated me for several things. It had nothing to do with that. But I should say it would have been extremely difficult. I did it for years here in San Francisco in my early days. I knew the name of the reliable abortionist, and I gave him it out to, I guess, maybe 20 people in town who asked me if I knew anybody. But he was finally... caught up with and sent to San Quentin, so that was the end of that.
Was that in the 20s?
Hmm?
Was that in the 20s?
That was in the 20s. As I remember, you paid him $50 and you got the abortion and you were sent home in a limousine. But if I remember correctly, the reason he got caught was that he performed an abortion on some Italian woman and her husband found out about it and came and tried to shoot him. Then one thing led to another until he went to San Quentin.
How So that kind of information, though, in radical circles was easily available.
It's much more available in radical circles, certainly, than in conservative circles. I never discussed the question with anybody who wasn't one of the extreme left. But they, all those anarchist women I knew, took it for granted that they knew all about it. And as far as abortion goes, I don't know, except for that one doctor that of his own accord, I never asked him. He said, I'll run an operation if the ergot doesn't work. I've never had a doctor say anything about it to me.
It almost seems like they were much more willing to do it in those days than even while it was still illegal.
I think so, yeah, of course. But it was an extremely dangerous and risky thing, I mean, for the doctor. There was a stiff prison sentence attached to being caught.
What kind of sentence was that? Do you remember what he got, for instance?
Well, I wouldn't want to say and be quoted, but my impression was that he got something like 10 years. And several years ago, I was at a convention of some sort, and I can't remember what, but there was an old ex-doctor from somewhere in the Middle West who had been famous for performing, I think he said he performed 3,000 abortions in this little town in the Middle West somewhere. And then they finally got him, and he was not only had served a prison sentence, he was an old man when I heard him. And I don't remember much about him, except that then, of course, he couldn't practice medicine anymore. He was removed and the equivalent of being disbarred. And but he did it as a matter of conscience. He believed in abortion. And I don't, most of them, I think, were free, and he charged very little.
Of course,
there was a terrific amount of self-induced abortion, most of which ended in either lifelong injuries or death. Horrible things that I've heard that women did, help him, some nice pics and things like that.
That was essentially usually lower class women without much access, wasn't it? Or did it really cut across all class lines, do you think?
I don't think I got that list exactly.
Do you think it cut across all class lines?
Oh.
Self-induced abortions, or was it primarily
lower class? Well, the suffragists did, yes. But you see, the whole suffrage movement, after its earliest days, was divided into two camps, a conservative camp and a liberal camp. And as far as I know, the very conservative women suffragists were interested in nothing else. They weren't feminists, really. I mean, they didn't care much about working conditions or any birth control or anything of that sort. They were just after the vote. But I should say that the liberal camp was more or less favorable, at least, but nobody, never did anybody active in or prominent in the women's suffrage movement endorse abortion or anything of that sort. That would have been fatal. Even if they believed in it personally, they wouldn't do a thing to ruin the whole movement besides themselves.
Of the women that you know who you referred to this abortionist, did any of them have harmful after effects?
You mean people who did it themselves?
No, of the women that you referred to, this man you knew here in San Francisco.
Well, I don't know, because the word seemed to get around that I knew somebody, and people I didn't know would come and ask me for the address. I never hear them again. But and with nobody who was very close to me, there were people I just knew casually.
Oh.
But as far as I know, they were all alive and kicking afterwards. The man, he was a regular doctor, and he was a good one. I don't know whether he did charge $50, I said, which was an enormous price in those days. But so he wasn't doing it out of
goodwill,
love for humankind or anything, but he was reliable. He was at least scientific and sanitary, which is more than most of them were.
See, one of the interesting things that I've been coming across is the number of women in your age range that I've been interviewing who've had hysterectomies, some of which seem to have been related to very botched up abortions.
Well, I don't know. I never heard that before.
You yourself never had a hysterectomy.
No, I never had to.
Because it seems like it was fairly common in those days. I'm coming across.
Is that what?
I'm coming across a lot of incidents.
Oh, I should think so. Yes. Oh,
common.
I wouldn't wonder. In later years, in the late 1920s, I knew a woman who had 7 abortions, and one of them the 7th month, which is frightful. She was, as far as I could see, healthy and active. Young looking. She had the girl, I think her first one was when she was 16. But she didn't bother with any kind of birth control. When she got pregnant, she went and had an abortion.
I can think of better ways.
Yeah, I can too. She finally decided in one of her marriages, she married several times, she decided to have a child and had it. And the child was born dead, and she blamed the doctor. So after that, she refused to have any more.
Going back to the split in the feminist movement between the more conservative and the more radical, did the more radical group use the word feminism?
To begin with, they were not a radical group. They were liberal. They were only left as compared with the extreme right. And don't ask me to name any names because I don't remember who was the head of which. Mm-hmm. But yes, I have known women all my life who are lifelong feminists. For instance, Congressman Kent's widow, who gave Kent, gave Muir Woods to the mm-hmm. country, was an old-time feminist from way back. I remember going up to her house and making a speech once to a little group of old-time feminists.
When was that?
All that was about, let's see, it was the day our house caught on fire. I think that was about 1929 or 30.
And most of them still identified as feminists.
Oh, yes, and an old lady, 93 years old, drove me back and told me about a fight for feminism back about 70 years before that. But let's say they were extremely few.
And they would use the word feminism.
Oh, yes,
to
absolutely,
themselves.
Yes. You see, aside from, there were a great many people who were suffragists who were not interested or at least not talking about anything else. The old-time feminists go way back, keep on going back all the way to the 1840s. Usually they believed in a lot of other things that the more respectable didn't, like free love. Mm-hmm. And a good many of them were actually anarchists. Of course, Anna Goldman, you know, lectured regularly on birth control.
Right. Now, of these, one of the things that I'm very interested in is someone like yourself, who was a feminist, and who lived through all of that, and who remained a feminist all your life. What do you think happened? Why did, after the vote, why did things get so much worse for women again?
Well, I think one reason was that women expected too much from the vote. You know, politics was going to be purified, and everything was going to be lovely as soon as women got the vote, which was pure nonsense. My argument always was that we're human beings and citizens, and we had a right to the vote. I never thought that women legislators would be any less corruptible than men, because we're all human together. We had all kinds. But I think that is one of the chief reasons. A good many people who had worked hard for suffrage gave up in disgust and despair when they found that they weren't entering into an Elysium. And then, of course, you must remember we've had 2 world wars since then, and 2 private wars, and, you remember during World War I was the first time that Rosie the Riveter appeared, and the women got all the... Then, I imagine a great many of those people who had never been interested in anything except their own private lives, when at the end of the war they'd get turned off summarily and the men get their job, I imagine a good many of them began to think about women as women. But I don't know that I have any definitive answer at all to why, except that, you know how people are, they get tired, they get bored, and then they get old.
Why do you think, though, among the more liberals, the ones who identified as feminists and not just suffragists, because these had a much broader idea?
Well, I think because in the minds of a great many people who would call themselves liberals, feminism was a fighting word. It belonged too far to the left. They weren't radicals politically, and it was the political radicals who were. And I think that's probably the fundamental reason. Mm-hmm. And a great many people who wanted the vote didn't want anything else, and they got the vote, they were satisfied.
But for instance, these feminists that you went to speak to, after the vote, what did they do? Did they still fight for?
They were all very old people, and they weren't doing much of anything. I don't think there were more than half a dozen at that meeting. But occasionally, I can remember my husband's lectures. There used to be an old lady who came up from Palo Alto. I don't remember her name, but she had been a lifelong feminist and always, in the question period, always managed, no matter what the scientific subject, astronomy or anything, to get it around somehow to women. We expected it. We were waiting for it. But until the new modern women's lib movement, you hardly heard the word feminism. Mm-hmm. I don't think most people would have understood what it was. And then I think one thing is that as the more permissive era arrived, too many of the older women who had thought of themselves as being pretty far, pretty liberal, began worrying for fear that only lesbians were.
Oh,
yeah, I think that had a great deal to do with it. I think a great many people got scuttled out in a hurry in the fear that they might be considered lesbians.
And that would be in the 20s?
That would be, oh, not in the 20s, but I mean later than that. No, in the 20s nobody knew unless you read French, you hardly knew what lesbian was. Unless you read Greek and Sappho. I remember my Latin professor in college introduced me to the novels of Pierre Louis in French, and he had one called Aphrodite about Greek lesbians, and that was the first I ever heard of them. No, the very first I ever was on my first paper. We had a woman in the advertising department, and everybody called brother, and I never could understand why. Until she asked to use our phone one day and called up some woman and said, "Darling, did you like the ring?" She lived right around the corner from me and invited me over. She was the person who taught me to smoke when I was 18. But she never made any advances to me. Funny thing was that when I first moved out here in 1918, to my immense astonishment, I met her on the street. She moved out here too. She was living with some woman on Lake Street, but I never saw her again.
Well, when was this period where you're saying that the women who would still identify themselves as
well, I think
were afraid
that,
of lesbians?
I think that's a. I should say that was just before the. When the women's lib movement started, you know, the lesbians greeted it with great pleasure. I went out to an NOW fair out in the courtyard of the Unitarian Church about 3 years ago, and different, you know, there were all kinds of stands, you know, with literature and things, and there was some girl who had been making elaborate printed poems, big plaques like that printed by hand, and I've never seen anything quite so vicious as one of them she had posted up there, anti-man. Men were just horrible creatures that all women should avoid. So I went up to her and I said, I may have told you this before, but, and I said, "Look, we don't hate all men. We hate male chauvinist pigs." She said, "They're all male chauvinist pigs." So I think there were too many respectable and middle-aged women who had always thought of themselves as feminists. When they got that kind of thing, they got scared and beat it.
Was the anti-man stand as strong in the early feminist movement, do you think?
I think that's a question of the individual. There were women like that, and there were, after all, most of the early, the really early leading feminists in this country were married. And usually their husbands were very strong, too, for women, too, and were their associates, people like Alice Stone Blackwell.
But, for instance, when you were in Boston and involved with that suffrage group, do you recall?
No, the suffrage movement in Boston was very mild and very conservative. The head of it was a woman named Maud Park, who I think couldn't have been more respectable or more conservative. She was a sweet little woman. She's been married 6 months when her husband died, and she wore mourning for him the rest of her life. So you can see that we weren't what... it sounds very radical to get out in a soapbox and stand on the street corner, but everybody did it. I mean, conservative political candidates that was the day of the soapbox. Mm-hmm. Every evening when you went downtown, every corner was occupied.
Now, in that group, would other women besides yourself talk about feminist issues, or was only...
I would talk about anything except what's a good corner and who will circulate the petitions tonight. I never knew any of them personally. See, I just went down and offered my services, and I had some experience in public speaking, so they took me on. And I suppose for several years, I was out two or three times a week in the evening. But I never had any... The woman who was the head of our home for self-supporting women, I am away, was one of the conservative women suffrage people. She came from Alabama. And, which is unusual in those days, Southern women were very, very reactionary. And I think she was the one who first suggested that I offer my services to speak in the evening, so she would never have dreamed of doing it. And I don't think she even had marched in a parade. But she was... Well, she did once register to vote, tried to. I mean, it's a demonstration. That was one of the things that they did, you know. Different women would go down when it was time to register and try to register and be turned down and get some publicity for the cause out of that.
Had you done that ever?
Hmm?
Did you do that ever?
I never did, no. For one thing, when I first started, I was a minor. And then I got into so many other things, I never did that. I don't think I'd live.